Welcome to the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. Have you ever wondered how people succeed in real estate and what steps they took to get there? If so, this podcast is for you. Your hosts, Sayla and Eileen Prack, interview top experts in the real estate community to share with you their real estate journey and how they achieved massive success. Our goal is to provide you with valuable real estate resources and to help you apply it to your own real estate goal. Welcome to today's episode of the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Eileen Prack. And today, our guest is Ryan Groney, and he began his career with a family-owned single-family rental and public equity investments. Since then, he's expanded his portfolio to encompass over 160 mobile home park spaces and has successfully managed operations for more than 700 mobile home spaces. And currently, he serves as the director of operations at Buckeye Communities, where he's responsible for overseeing operations for 500 manufactured housing spaces and enhancing the overall value of the portfolio. So Ryan, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And it sounds like I sent you my old bio. I do apologize. And I'm happy to update that. I can kind of just jump right into my background.
Yeah, absolutely. Please.
I used to work in finance back in like 2012. I graduated from finance, thought I was going to work on Wall Street. Ended up going to New York City one time. I didn't like it. Wasn't for me. I got a corporate finance job, worked there for a handful of years, read Rich Dad, Poor Dad in college, thought I wanted to I looked at laundromats, car washes, small apartment buildings, actually stumbled on mobile home parks, and then later got into RV parks. I looked at doing a live-in flip on a mobile home, and then kind of went down the rabbit hole of who owns mobile home parks, found out that, there's a huge demand for affordable housing and a really, really low supply. So simple economics, right? Lots of demand, low supply. You always have a customer and a decent price basis, and nobody's building any more of them. So that's kind of why we got into it. I did work at Buckeye Communities. That's how I kind of cut my teeth running operations over there. I've been on my own since 2018. Simultaneously, I was working for them. My company is Treeside Capital, which I have with one other business partner. I've owned over 20 mobile home parks and RV parks kind of through the Midwest and the Southeast, and we're continuing to buy MH and RV parks, and I'm happy to dive into the either asset class, but that's kind of brought you up to speed on my background. We have a little bit over 1,200 units that we've had, and we've sold some parks over the years as well.
Fantastic. So let's start with the mobile home parks for a little bit, and then we'll transition into how you got into RV parks and what that takes as well. So mobile home parks, how were you able to get into your first deal, and how long did it take you to find that property, underwrite it, get it on the contract, close it?
Yeah. So my first park, when I started looking for mobile home parks, it was 2015. I was 25, had owned no other real estate, and it took me a couple years to find a deal that I actually wanted to buy. So I found a park in Fayetteville, North Carolina for sale, actually through a connection. Me and a few other partners bought it from a wholesaler. We bought the wholesale from a colleague that we knew. It was a 75-space mobile home park. It had contaminated water well and was septic. So it had all the things you don't want to buy on your first real estate deal. So we went in, we connected to city water, we repaved the roads, we raised the rent, and then we also brought in 20 homes. We had about 20, 25 vacant pads, units, because in mobile home parks, you have the land, right? And then people just rent the dirt from us. So when there's no home there, it's a vacant pad. So we bring in the homes, we sell them off or rent them. And then we ended up actually selling that park in 22, sorry. And we bought the park in late 2017, early 2018. And we did well in the deal, but it was my very first real estate transaction. It was a heavy turnaround, and it taught me a lot about MH. And overall, good property. MHs, typically, you want to buy in good areas, just like you do in any other real estate, right? Location's number one. And then all the other stuff, price, deal terms come into play.
So that first mobile home park, you said it had 75 occupied spaces?
It had about 55 occupied sites.
50 occupied.
Out of 75 total available units.
I see. And so there were 25 empty lots that you were able to bring in 25 more mobile homes to fill those empty lots.
Correct. That is correct.
Okay. So when you're bringing in those mobile homes, you purchase them outright, and then you said that you either sell them or lease them. How does that process typically work?
Yeah. So typically we're looking for either new or used inventory. Our preference is typically used because it's a little bit cheaper. Typically we have to spend the cash. A used mobile home typically will cost anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000. And then a new mobile home typically costs between $40,000 and $70,000. So there's a much difference of a price difference, right? The advantage to a new home is obviously it's brand new. And then also a lot of the manufacturers that make them offer programs like financing programs for the actual community owner, who is us, right? So we may be able to buy a new mobile home, leverage it, put some financing on it. We're putting 10, 20% down. So we only have to bring, you know, on a $50,000 home, we only have to bring $5,000 to $10,000. But the kicker in the mobile home business, which a lot of people don't consider when they're looking at it, is the setup cost, because there is a setup to prep the pad. You got to tie it down. You got to put infrastructure in place, water, sewer, electric, steps, skirting around the mobile home. That can cost anywhere from $8,000 to $15,000 on top of the purchase of the home, because you also have to transport it. And the transportation is included in that $8,000 to $15,000, but it costs a lot more than what people realize. So therefore, when it costs that much, it creates a sticky tenant for us. When a resident is in there, they typically leave the home. They will either go to sell the home or we buy the home from them back, right? So when you're infilling a community like we did, the 20, 25 sites, we did a combination of new and used. And then we typically go to sell the home. We either will do like a rent-to-own situation if they cannot qualify for third-party financing, or at a last resort, we'll rent the home, but that's really not our preference. We want people to be homeowners. We just want to be in the land business where people are renting the dirt from.
So how is that property operating with the initial 50 homes already occupied? And then what did bringing in 25 additional homes to fill those lots, what did that do to the returns and then the costs in general?
Yeah, so you're always weighing your cost-benefit analysis, right? When you're bringing in homes to a mobile home community, it costs a lot of money. And you don't see that return typically until the end of the movie, right? You're not going to see it until you refinance the park or sell the park. Or if you're lucky, you may be able to get somebody to come in and pay cash for the home, or they can qualify for third-party financing, which then that third party would then cut you or the manufacturer a check, right? So then you're getting it off of your books. So what it does is it increases the occupancy of the park. It also increases the NOI of the park, the net operating income, which increases the value, just like in commercial real estate, it's all valued off of commercial, off of NOI. So in the end, you're creating a much more valuable park because you're infilling the units, the vacant units. And then also you're compressing your cap rate a little bit because you're now closer to 100% occupancy. So what it did was, let's say you're going to sell the park for $50,000 a unit. You have roughly about $50,000 that you can work with. Because in the on the back end, when you go to sell or refinance the park, you have to keep that in mind. Because if you're spending $100,000 per lot per unit, and you can only sell the park for $50,000 a unit, you're underwater $50,000. So you really want to keep that in mind when you're looking to infill a park as well. What's that value of that unit, and then what are you spending to infill? But normally it takes, you know, 3 to 5 years to infill a park, and then also raise the rent. And then that's when you see the value of it, is when you're getting the cash flow in the meantime, but that appreciation that you're forcing by infill is when you refinance or go to sell them.
So when you're doing your analysis and your underwriting for these properties, what is your typical assumption for the baseline on whether you're going to rent it or you're going to sell it off to individuals? Is the underlying assumptions is to rent all the units on the lot?
So that the goal is always to create a tenant-owned community, which means they are just renting the dirt from us. We don't want to be in the rental business. That is the ultimate goal in our business model. And a lot of mobile home community owners don't want to own the homes. They want to have a tenant just pay lot rent, which is they're just renting the dirt from you on a month-to-month basis or on an annual basis. Our assumption going in is, what's the lot rent currently? What can we take it to? What can we pass through utility-wise? Can we pass through water? Can we pass through sewer? Can we pass through trash? And then sometimes we'll have to pass through gas or electric, but majority of the time we're not paying that. And then how can we improve the park in the meantime, right? Do the roads need redone? Do trees need cut? We're looking to provide safe, clean, affordable housing at the end of the, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we're getting at. But we're also looking and considering what are we paying per unit now? And then what can that park be worth when we go to exit, you know, or refinance in the future? If we're buying a park for $20,000 an occupied unit, can we sell it for $50,000, right? And that's what we're looking for. We're looking to increase the value, clean it up, and then refinance into long-term like agency debt, or we'll sell the property if we need to.
So how do you see the mobile home market right now currently with the amount of demand and then the supply that you guys have as well, or the supply in the industry in general?
Yeah, so as long as you're not buying like literally in the middle of nowhere where there's nobody around for 2 hours, and even then there probably is a demand. I just don't own anything that rural. We're typically in primary and tertiary markets. The affordable housing costs for a single family home, I think the average like 3 or 4 years ago was like 300,000. I think now it's upwards of close to 450 in certain markets, right? So most Americans, which the average medium income in America is what, 55,000 to 60,000 roughly, when you're not in the bigger cities, you know, middle America, the supply of the mobile home parks is dwindling, right? Because it's the NIMBY mentality, which is not in my backyard. So a lot of them, just due to the fact that the land use is actually is worth more in another type of asset, whether it be a single family home development, townhomes, apartments, or a strip center, typically the land use is worth more for another asset than it is a mobile home park. So you have that in play, right? People are destroying them because it's worth more in another asset class. And then you also have the fact that most counties, most towns don't want mobile home parks in their area, because the reason being is, one, there's a stigma, right? So there's a stigma that they're not worth it. People, you know, there's all kinds of stigmas that go along with it. Most of the time, those aren't true. But the main driver why there are not being more developed and why there's more being destroyed, even though there's a crazy demand for affordable housing, is the fact that it doesn't drive a lot of tax revenue for the county or city, right? So you have one landowner, and then you have all of this personal property, because it's personal property, not real property. Mobile homes are personal property. So personal property taxes are much lower than real property taxes. And then you also have a tenant who is typically using most of the social services within the community. So it's not a huge tax driver for the town or for the county or for the city, right? But that's why they don't want to develop. They'd rather have 20, 30, 100 single family homes, because they're going to be able to tax every single person. That person also probably has a higher income, so they can tax that income. There's just more of a taxable basis from a land use perspective. And that's why a lot of mobile home parks are not being developed, because economically, they don't make sense from allowing it from a town perspective, even though it would solve the affordable housing crisis in 2 seconds, because, you know, it's $40,000-$50,000 for a home, and the lot rent is like $300 to $400 nationwide. That's kind of the average right now. It has gone up in the last couple of years, but that's kind of the basis of why there's dwindling supply, because economically it doesn't normally make sense to allow it to happen.
What transitioned you into the RV space? How did you get into that asset class?
Yeah, so we were buying mobile home parks, and we still are. But within our mobile home communities, sometimes we have RVs. Some towns allow RVs to be in mobile home parks. You're in Southern California. I'm in Charleston. If you've ever been to Florida or Southern Texas or even Arizona, there are lots of people that live in RVs part-time, right? They're called snowbirds, right? They live up north in the summer. And then in the winter, they go down south, right, to Florida. And they may live in a mobile home or they live in an RV. So 2021, the mobile home business really got consolidated from a lot of Wall Street money, and a lot of kind of like self-storage had happened about 10 years prior. A lot of REITs got back into the business. A lot of Wall Street money consolidated the business. A lot of the mom and pops went away. They got bought out. But we started looking at RV parks because it was the same avenue, kind of same asset class, and we were finding a lot of deals. We were finding 10, 11 cap rates right off the bat. A lot of owners wanted to sell. So we bought a handful of those, and we were getting the same bank debt, or we were getting seller financing that we were getting in the mobile home world. So we said, hey, let's just go down this avenue. Our whole investment thesis was let's run them as RV parks. When times are good it's going to be great, right? People are going to travel. They're going to live in, they're going to be in their RVs. We're going to get cash flow that way. But if the economy falls apart, or, you know, the world falls apart, we turn it into affordable housing, because believe it or not, about 4 to 6 million Americans live in an RV full time, or they live in it for half of the year, right? So we buy in populated areas, in decent towns, or right off a major highway, and we make sure that a majority of the spaces have full hookup, water, sewer, electric, and then we turn it into affordable housing if we need. So it's still the same play that we have in the mobile home world, but when times are good, people are traveling or making cash flow, and then when times are bad, we say, hey, we have a spot for you. You pay us $500, $600 a month. You can live in your RV here. So that's what got us into the business. Better returns with the same debt and more opportunity.
So operating an RV park and versus a mobile home park, are the underlying operations part of it, are they similar in aspect where they're renting the lot from you and they're just paying for certain utilities down at the bottom? Or, and what are the major differences between owning the mobile home versus an RV park?
So the major difference is that it costs almost nothing other than having a truck or an SUV and a hitch to haul off your RV, versus you have to be commercially licensed to be able to haul off a mobile. That's the major difference, the cost. So I could have a full mobile home park over, and then versus an RV park, it could be full on Friday. And then come Monday or Tuesday, my RV park might be vacant because everybody leaves for the weekend or they can pull it out. That's the major difference, right? The tenant isn't as sticky. We have about the same demand for both. I would say we have more demand for the mobile home parks, just given the fact that it's affordable housing. The second difference is for every 100 units we have on the MH, we have 1 to 2 employees. For versus RV, we have about probably 4 to 6 employees, whether it be part-time, full-time. And the reason being is we have more amenities. And most of our MH mobile home parks, we don't have pools. We don't have a lot of amenities. In our RV parks, we might have like a hotel, or we have firewood, we have propane cells, we have a beer and wine store, like a convenience store. We have a big pool. We might have kayaks for the lake or fishing. We have different amenities that we offer because people want something to do when they're camping, right? We also bring in bands. We have cookouts. We have all kinds of activities. And we have that in the mobile home parks a little bit. We try to offer a little bit of community, but we don't offer as many amenities as we do with the RV park. And that's the major difference. And then also the second is branding, making sure that we're on the up and up with the RV parks, because we want customer attrition. It's like a hotel type of business. You want people to on the up and up versus the mobile home park. We still want the up and up, but people still need somewhere to live, right? So that's the major difference, is it's a living scenario. Now, when we switch our RV parks, we do have some what we call extended stay, right? Where people live in their RVs and we allow them to stay month to month. We're still offering amenities. We still try to take care of the park. We do that in all of our assets, but we run that more like a mobile home park than we do an RV park. And we take care of everything, but we may not have like all the activities that we would have in like a seasonal or a transient RV park, where people are turning over a little bit more frequently, just because people are there for the activities versus living. So that's the majority of the difference. And it's a different business model in both asset classes, but they're kind of streamlined within the same kind of set, if that makes sense.
Right. So for the RVs, is there a size allocation that you need to reserve for each individual RV in comparison to where the next one will be placed?
As far as like a footage? Yes. Or like a spot?
Yes.
Yeah, it all depends. So RVs can vary widely, just like mobile homes can. Typically, when we're buying a park, they're already existing sites. So they may have 10 sites that can accommodate a 30-foot RV. And then over in this section, they can accommodate a 50-foot RV. So typically, it's already preset for us. The biggest RVs typically are like 60 to 70 foot. That's like the max. While a mobile home, the largest mobile home is 80 foot. And then you can also have a double wide mobile home where it's like 48 wide, versus an RV, it's going to be like, it's got to be roadworthy. So it's only going to be 6-7 foot wide at the most, right? So that's kind of how we do it. I mean, it's already typically laid out. Now, if we're developing a community, we're looking at, you know, what is that? How do you turn the car? And we have typically hand it over to the pros, which is the engineer, let them figure it out. And then we kind of just pay the bill. I hate saying that, but that's I don't know enough about the development of it. It's, you know, you got to have a wide enough road, wide enough turn angle, whether it's a pull through site or a back end. And then you definitely need, like, each spot you're looking for 10 foot to 20 foot wide in an RV park. And you want the bigger, the better, typically, because you're going to accommodate bigger and smaller rigs. So you want that site typically 10 to 15 foot wide by probably 80 to 100 foot in depth.
So Ryan, what's next for you?
We are looking to continue to grow, you know, in the mobile home park and the RV park world. We're vertically integrated from a management perspective. We keep everything in house. We're looking to buy, you know, in the Midwest and the Southeast. We partner on deals. We do syndicate. We do raise money that way as well, but we don't have a fund or anything like that. That's our goal, just to buy a good few parks here in 2024. I don't have anything in particular. I'm not looking to go out and buy 20 parks. We're kind of a little bit more cautious in 2024 just because of the debt market, and with the coming presidential election, there's a lot of things that are going on. So we're more focused on mobile home parks than we are RV parks at the moment. But the hottest asset class in 2024 is going to be RV parks. I mean, there's a lot of people moving into that space, and there's a lot of people getting attracted to that space because of, one, they know it because they've camped before, and two, it's a growing industry, and three, there's some opportunity to consolidate.
So Ryan, how has real estate investing impacted your life?
It has impacted my life because I no longer have a W-2. I haven't had a W-2 since 2018. It's not for everybody. I mean, it's not the easiest. It's not the hardest. As far as being entrepreneurial, it's probably easier than owning a business. I would say that because it's a pretty easy hurdle to operate a park. You know, or even operate real estate. You collect rent, pay your bills, and take care of the asset. It's fairly simple. But real estate investing has it's changed my life for sure. And even if you're working a regular job, you can still invest in real estate. Typically, people don't know that they can invest through a self-directed IRA, through their 401k, or if they have a home equity line, you can pull that. I'm not advising that. There's plenty of ways to invest in real estate, or just invest as a whole. That's what I always recommend. Get invested, because if you're not investing, then you're really losing money, especially with inflation at where it is.
And what is the one thing you know now about real estate that you wish you knew when you first started?
What I wish I knew back then was, it's not really even real estate related. You're only imposing, or typically self-limitations, right? So like, if you think you can't buy real estate, you're not going to buy real estate. Like, I emptied my 401k, bought a mobile home park, and then, you know, I've bought many more. But a lot of times we just self-impose our own limitations, and then that's the majority of issues, right? You're going into real estate investing, get educated first, and then try and find a deal later, right? But you want to do it simultaneously. And real estate investing is a great avenue, a great career. It's not going anywhere, because typically they're not building more of it. So you can always typically make money, but you can lose money as well. And a lot of people have lost their shirts. So just go in moderately leveraged, make sure you're assessing your risk. And as Sam Zell would say, low risk, high reward, we'll always do that deal. So.
And what is the one thing that sets successful people apart in real estate investing?
Just keep trying time after time, right? Because a lot of people think they want to do it, and then it's just small daily actions to moving to buy more parks or buy more assets, right? And there's nothing wrong with having a W-2 while also trying to real estate invest.
So Ryan, where can our listeners find out more about you and what you're doing?
So you can go to our website, which is treesidecapital.com. I'm also on all the social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, just at Ryan Groney. And I'm happy to connect with other listeners.
Fantastic. Ryan, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
And thank you for listening to our podcast today, brought to you by Bonavest Capital. We would really appreciate it if you can go to iTunes right now and leave a rating and written review. Also, please don't forget to subscribe so you can always get the latest episodes. You can also connect with us on Facebook, How Did They Do It Real Estate. We'd love to hear your feedback and any topics that you're interested in for future episodes. If you're anything like Zayla and me and believe that real estate investing is a great way to create passive income and build long-term wealth, check out our free apartment syndication due diligence checklist for passive investors at bonavestcapital.com/checklist.
Dale and I created this checklist for ourselves as we evaluated different multifamily syndication opportunities as a passive investor. So we would love to share it with you so you can use it as a resource as well. Download your free copy today at bonavestcapital.com/checklist. Lastly, to learn more about us, you can go to bonavestcapital.com and fill out the contact us page so you can speak to us directly. Nothing on the show should be considered as specific personal advice. Please consult your legal, tax, and real estate professionals for individualized advice.